Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad you tuned in, and a very happy Wednesday to you. Well, I always open the show with a question for you to ponder, and this question actually might stir you up a bit. Are you ready? What irritates you? Don't give me a call. Just think about it. What irritates you? In what ways do you lose patience, you know, more quickly than you ought? Okay, I'll go first. And if you listen often enough, you know this about me already. I shouldn't, but I do. I get quickly irritated with drivers who are texting and they're slowing traffic down and they're putting others in danger. Now, that may sound noble enough, but impatience really, it's not a fruit of the Spirit. In fact, it's often an indicator of a sense of entitlement. So if you dig a little deeper, my attitude actually reveals this mindset. I deserve not to be on the road with you. I'm thinking, not really, but sort of, I think maybe you should go into a ditch, spend some time texting so you don't hurt anybody else and traffic can speed back up again. Well, how do you find yourself thinking, I deserve this? I'm entitled to this. Well, I want you to think about this because we're talking to Dr. John Townsend today about our sense of entitlement. And entitlement, he says, has profound negative impact. And let me just read you a list of things he's identified in his amazing book, The Entitlement Cure. Companies that must deal with unmotivated employees, parents faced with raising self-centered children, dating relationships that don't work because of an I'm special, I deserve more than you're giving me attitude. Young adults who refuse to grow up and so go nowhere. Leaders who expect special treatment because of their position, not because of their character. Marriages torn apart by the narcissism of a spouse. Ministries saddled with a prima donna leadership. Professionals who wander from job to job looking for a place that will see them as the wunderkind, I think I'm saying that right, they consider themselves to be, whether they're productive or not. So what do you think about it? I want you to think about the fruit of entitlement. And my guest today also says that we all have pockets of it somewhere. So it's before we point fingers and identify people in our lives that irritate us to no end, we're going to take a personal inventory as well. Second hour, Dr. Greg and Aaron Smalley will join me to talk about some key elements to lifelong romance. Okay, so let me tell you about my first hour guest. We'll get him on the show. Dr. John Townsend is a leadership coach, organizational consultant, psychologist, and best-selling author. He consults with corporations, family-owned businesses, and small businesses. He's written or co-written 25 books, selling, listen to this, over 5 million copies. Dr. Townsend is active on the board of Mustard Seed Ranch, a residential program for abused children. He and his wife, Barbie, have two sons, and they live in Newport Beach, California. You can find his influencer page on our website at myfaithradio.com. Dr. John, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be back, Susie.
Always good to talk with you. So before we get into the content of your book, I told you before the show that we could have 5-hour-long conversations and still not touch all of the content in this book. But before we get there, is there a passage of Scripture you've been thinking about lately that you can share with us?
I've been thinking about one of my favorite passages, Ephesians 3:20, where God promises that he's going to do way beyond anything we can imagine. And I think we're also often limited in what we want and desire and dream for because we think, well, it couldn't happen. But beyond what you can imagine is where God lives. So we need to kind of hold on to that.
Beyond what you can imagine. Awesome. I have to ask you a quick question. You wouldn't happen to be on speaker, would you?
I don't think so. Do I have kind of a...
There we go. That's better.
Yeah. Is that better? Oh. You know what? My little headset was too far away from my mouth. How's that?
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Susie, that just proved that you're not entitled because you were vulnerable. You asked for what you needed. You didn't say, don't you know I'm a radio star? John, you were so nice. You're not entitled at all.
I'm so glad. So that didn't come across as, I deserve to hear you better than I'm hearing you now. Anyway, this is such good stuff. In fact, you say the entitlement is the belief that I'm exempt from responsibility and I'm owed special treatment. Say more if you would.
Well, it's number one, it's an attitude that unfortunately is not only in the world but in our churches too. And it comes from a sense of I shouldn't care how my behavior impacts anybody else. If I do what I do, I need to do what I want to do, no matter how it affects family and marriage and people at work. When you combine that with the other attitude of I deserve something for nothing, I deserve special treatment, you got kind of nitroglycerin, because what happens is life as God designed it breaks down. Businesses don't work, marriages struggle, kids suffer, because a person who's living like that is really kind of living antagonistically to God's principles of love and responsibility and humility.
Boy, you make it so plain, and yet it's not so plain all the time. I mean, we all have these blind spots. Wondering how we catch the entitlement disease. Have you noticed and identified a recipe for disaster, so to speak?
Yeah, I really have. When I did the research on it, and I studied a lot of corporations I work with, and the Bible, and neurological research, there's three culprits in this. The first is, unfortunately, from our mom and dad, Adam and Eve, who back in the fall, they saw something they weren't entitled to have, which was the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, and they thought, well, I can decide better than God. So we have that. Secondly, we have a culture these days that takes entitlement and puts it in kind of like a nice Christmas package with a bow on it that says, you're just taking care of yourself. Now, I'm all about self-care. I'm a psychologist, and you've got to be healthy so that you can give more. But self-care and entitlement are two different things, and they get this confused in the culture. And then the third thing is that now that we have so many family dysfunctions with divorce and problems with single parenting and all the stress that leaves, we've got a lot of parents who unknowingly, and I do mean that unknowingly, they think they're loving their children when actually they're enabling their children. And the children grow up feeling like they deserve more than they get because mom and dad either feel guilty or get too close or become helicopters. So those three things really add up.
You know, in thinking about Scripture, it says train up our children in the way they should go. I have three adult sons now. You sure can see when you train them up so that they'll be happy and you don't have to encounter too much conflict, it's really a disaster waiting to happen, isn't it?
It really is. You know, when you look at the research, this is why I love research, because the really good research, Susie, it just basically supports everything the Bible's been saying. And when you look at what makes the best parent with the best outcome being a child, the meta studies comes down to two things, always two things. One is warmth. In other words, parents should be warm, affectionate, affirming, cuddling, positive. That's warmth. And the second is that they are appropriately strict, that they're not mean, but they have very clear rules and house boundaries and consequences and structure. And that's the oven that a good child comes out of and feels like I'm ready to take on the world and get married and find faith and, you know, get a job. And what happens is a lot of times the parent is really great on the warmth part, but kind of doesn't follow through on the appropriate strictness part, and the result is entitlement.
Hmm. I don't know if I told you this story last time, but I was just, as you're talking, I'm thinking of my youngest when he was in high school. They had senior skip day, and he came and he said, my friend's mom is calling him in sick so he can be gone for senior skip day. And I'm wondering, he wouldn't even look me in the eye. I'm wondering if you do that for me. And I said, well, what do you think I'm going to say? He said, I think you're going to say no because we're responsible. I'm like, wow, that was pretty good. You got it right.
Like, you were listening the last 15 years.
I was sort of hoping if I don't look you in the eye, I could somehow scoot around this. But, oh, I thought that was hilarious. But anyway, I'm like, yeah, I think you got your answer right there. But, you know, and you talk about some of these extreme levels of entitlement that go to narcissism and how painful it is and ways we can address it. But for a moment, I want to keep it on all of us, because you even say that our own sense of entitlement is revealed in this oft-repeated question to God, why do you let so many bad things happen in the world? That's a question that we can even sound noble in asking, but we're in some ways pitting ourselves against God by asking it. Talk about how that very question reveals a sense of entitlement in us.
Yeah, there are two ways that this happens. First off, that question in and of itself isn't necessarily an entitled question. I mean, look at David in the Psalms. God, why are you you know, I'm a king, and why am I in the cave, and Saul's coming and going to kill me, but didn't you make me king? So there's that sort of why that confusion that we had and David had and Job had of why is that? To me, that's just a really legit thing, because we all look at life and say it should work this way, but it doesn't. But then there's the one driven by entitlement, which is you need to play by my rules. I'm a nice person. Why did I lose my job? I'm a nice guy and I play by the rules, and so I should have a great marriage and a great kids and all that. And that's sort of like, now, who's God here? Mm. So it can sound the same, but one's driven by more entitlement than confusion.
Mm. Love this. You said, my way of looking at life is beyond his. So it's almost more lamenting and crying out to God is one thing, but getting offended with and as if stating as if I know more than you do, that's where we're on dangerous ground. This was so, so good. You said God has not left us alone to struggle with a broken culture, broken lives, broken companies, and broken relationships. He is moving among us with his answers and his power. I felt like that was just so important, because in the midst of very real suffering on this earth, in the midst of our own entitlement mistakes, I love this. He's not left us alone. He's actually moving among us with his answers and his power. Would you unpack that a bit more?
Yeah, it's really easy to look at the state of the world and think, did he just wind up this big clock and leave and go somewhere else and say, deal with it? Because you often don't find that the things that he says that are important happen, like justice in the world and peace and people and community and helping the poor. And the answer has always been, when you read the Bible, is faith, that God is going to keep his promises every time, on his time schedule and not ours. And the happiest people in the world that I know are the ones that go, look, I don't have the big telescope, but he does. And I know what he said, the way it's going to roll up, and it's not happening right now, but I'm stepping out in the water like Peter and having faith he'll do it. But people that say, I need to see evidence every second that he's going to do what I need for him to do, they're more of the milk than meat people. This sort of that's what a very young believer thinks, is he's the genie, and I'm gonna rub the lamp. But mature people go, this thing that's called eternity is a long, long road, and I can have faith that he's gonna bring things about to his own way.
And that's what it means to walk by faith, not by sight, to fix our eyes on what is unseen, not as what is seen. Talking to Dr. John Townsend today, I always love our conversations. Title of his book, The Entitlement Cure, Finding Success in Doing Hard Things the Right Way. We've got 5 copies, I think, of this beautiful hardcover book. This is it's a beautiful book on the outside, full of content on the inside. If you want a chance at getting a copy, you can call in with your comments, questions, 877-933-2484. Let your comments, let Grace know, and she'll pass those on. I want to give John as much time as possible. You can also email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put entitlement cure in the subject line. Give me your mailing address, because I can't chase after it. And we'll put your name in a drawing. 5 of you are going to win a copy of this great book. More with Dr. John Townsend when we return. John, speak to this, but I think one of the best antidotes for entitlement is gratitude. Man, open our hands and give thanks. Count your blessings out loud so your ears hear your own mouth say the things you're thankful for. God's been good, and he's going to be good again. We're talking about The Entitlement Cure, title of Dr. John Townsend's book, Finding Success in Doing Hard Things the Right Way. And John, you identify these characteristics of an entitled person, 4 of them. Love for us to walk through one by one, if it's okay. An attitude of being special. Can you say more about that one?
Yeah. What you find in the way God designed the universe is that we need to know that we're unique. You know, you read Psalm 139, for example, that you have made me, you have knit me in my mother's womb, and you may be incredibly complex and all that. And it's really good to know that you're unique, because that means that God spent time crafting us and we're important to him. But in our culture, the word unique is a great word. The word special has become a tough word, because special now means if you tell your kid this, your adult child this, somebody else, what people receive from that is, I'm above the rules. I'm special. I get special privileges. I don't have to get in the back of the line to go to recess, and I don't have to take that test because I'm special, and I don't have to, you know, practice really hard to be on the soccer team because I'm special. So I always recommend to both employers, because I work with leaders, and also with parents, is use the word unique. You know, use the word that you are created by God, but kind of be careful about the word special, because it can just say, I don't think reality applies to me, and that's a tough position.
Indeed. And we can take that a step further, John, and talk about just parents, how they can really help their child's character when they're having maybe an issue at school and the teacher's pointing out a character weakness, instead of coming to their defense, because it's such an indictment on us, that we would humble ourselves and say, we're going to be on top of this thing. I mean, I've heard from teachers again and again saying these great opportunities where we could sow something great into a child's character, they're time and time again met by a parent who bails that kid out because they can't themselves bear to be confronted.
Yeah, my wife's been a school teacher for 30 years, Susie, and we'll be having dinner about how was your day, and she'll say, you know, I finally understand this. She says, the parents that come in saying, you know, I can't believe you think that Jimmy's out of control, he's an angel at home, they're the checked out, the kind of clueless parents who turn a blind eye to this kid that's becoming a nightmare. She says, the greatest parents of the greatest kids are the ones who come in and say, well, how's Spencer doing? And the teacher says, he's doing really good. And they go, no, I'm asking about Spencer now. And the teacher goes, no, seriously, he's good. And they go, are you kidding me? Well, that's because they gave him love and limits at home and didn't let the entitlement happen, and that took some work. But by the time he gets to school, he's a pretty good kid.
Wow, that's a great picture. Okay, the next identifier, he says, an attitude of being owed, of deserving something. Love for you to speak to that, but also tell us where that comes from. And you touched on the parental, maybe enabling, but if there are other factors, I'd love to know those as well.
Yeah, this is a big part of what I talk about in the book. I say, watch out for the phrase, I deserve. I think it's a dangerous phrase. Now, certainly, you deserve a good wage if you work hard. And our veterans deserve the entitlements they get from our government, you know, and so do the poor who can't help themselves. That's totally true. But there's a phrase now, I deserve, that can just be a nightmare. Now that I'm 9 years old, I deserve a cell phone because my friends have it. Mm. Now that I'm 16, I deserve a car. And you know what? I deserve a great marriage, but I don't have to work for it. And I deserve a home. Well, I can't tell you how disempowering the phrase I deserve is, Susie. What it means is I'm going to sit here on the couch and wait for God or friends or the government or the church to come take care of me. You have no power. You have no choice. It's awful. And I say, change the words from I deserve to the following. I am responsible. I'm responsible to learn what it takes to buy a car. I'm responsible to go train for a good job and go to conferences and get a resume out. I'm responsible to be healthy enough and godly enough to have a good marriage. I'm responsible to manage my finances so I get a good home. Those are empowering words instead of disempowering.
So good. I'm thinking of the worn-out wife whose husband's holding out for management while he sits on the couch, you know what I mean, passing over one job after the other, and how heartbreaking it is because he sees himself in a way that maybe others don't see him. And
the problem behind that, I think, is a lot of times behind that guy is a mom who told him he was special and deserved everything, and now his wife has to clean up the pieces.
Yeah. Got a brother-in-law, my sister's husband. He and his brothers own this huge company of road work. You know, they got the big yellow trucks and they pave all the roads and highways. And he told his son, my nephew, one day you'll be, Lord willing, and one of the owners. But if you want that, you're starting at the bottom. And he would be out on that 100-degree, you know, pavement working. He missed big family vacations because the new guys didn't get vacations. And I'm telling you what, such an enigma in his generation to see this kid learn the value of hard work, of not having an entitlement bone in his body. He's just a force to reckon with as a young 20-something now. It's amazing. And it seems so harsh, but he said, you know, if you want this, you got to start like everybody else so you won't have the respect of your peers, you know?
You know, I remember, with that story, I remember being in college, and my dad was a great dad, but he never called me up and said, are you fulfilled?
Hmm.
He said, are you in jail? Are you making good grades? but he, but he never asked me if I was happy and fulfilled in college. He's just like, college is work. Get to work. And it was a great experience.
Interesting.
And I stayed out of jail, so that was good, too.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Sorry. A lot of things I could say there, but I won't. Okay. This listener writes in, and we got to take a break in about 3 minutes, so if you have to answer this on the other side, please feel free. He says, I'm curious what the doctor thinks about the Somali refugees who live in Minneapolis demanding that their religion blend in with our society. For example, taxi drivers who refuse a rider with a service dog. This is self-entitlement. Is this self-entitlement on their part in a negative sense? Is it not? What do you say?
Yeah, that's a great question. I believe that, you know, we are the melting pot, and I think we're a good example for other countries, and we need to respect everybody's religion. But I also believe that there's a law of the land, that the religion can't come in and tell the law what to do unless it's something truly immoral or unethical. So, no, you can practice religion if it doesn't get in the way of the freedoms that our founding fathers have so carefully constructed.
Good word. Okay, again, we've got about 2 minutes now, so we can pull this over to the other side if we need to. But the third identifier you said is a refusal to accept responsibility. Say more.
Well, what you notice in really, really mature people, like church leaders, really good business people, great parents, this sort of thing, there's something common in all of them, is that they have a very high sense of empathy, that they know if they make a decision that affects somebody, they care about it. Military leaders, they study military leaders, and the leaders that say, so many people are going to die by this move, but we're going to make it, the ones that stay up night and they're worried about that are much better leaders than the one that goes, well, it's just casualties and go have dinner. It's a high level of empathy. And when you don't have that high level of empathy and you think, you know, I can play video games, it's not hurting me, even though my family is struggling, or when you've got people who say, I can say what I want even if it's harsh and unloving because it's just how I feel, what you find that those people end up, number one, by alienating healthy people. Healthy people want to know that people have empathy for them. They're friends. They demand empathy. They want to know, you care about how you impact me. So they start getting a lower level of friendships. And secondly, they lose tremendously at work because work is a crucible for the way you perform affects the whole team. So entitled people kind of go, I'm just doing my thing, and they end up getting the worst jobs and the worst friends. God just can't be mocked. And unentitled people think, I got to think, is what I'm getting ready to say or do going to impact people that I love?
So, oh, sorry, we're cutting this so close, but I got to ask you, maybe I'll ask you and you can talk about it on the other side. Are some people just more wired, born with more empathy, or is this one of those learned things through the school of hard knocks or something that's groomed and trained by parents? I want you to answer that, John, if you would, on the other side. Loving this conversation with Dr. John Townsend. Again, his book is titled The Entitlement Cure. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put Entitlement Cure in the subject line. Give me your mailing address. You'll go in a drawing. Got a few copies to give away. If you've got a question, we'll open the phone lines here for just a couple of minutes. Get a question about entitlement. Love to hear from you. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. And let me tell you, if you get on the air with a question, we'll get a copy in your hands for sure. Don't go away. More with Dr. John Townsend when we return. With an entitled person, are you in a close relationship with someone who it's always about them and they're sort of blind to your needs and the needs around them? Well, I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Dr. John Townsend. We've had him on a handful of times. Always love our conversations with him. Title of his book is The Entitlement Cure, Finding Success in Doing Hard Things the Right Way. We're going to get to those hard things in a moment, but we're going through a list of characteristics he's identified of the entitled person, an attitude of being special, quote unquote, an attitude of being owed or of deserving something, a refusal to accept responsibility, and the denial of one's impact on others. You were talking about the empathy is such a strong indicator that we're going to have strong relationships. And an absence of it is weak relationships, weak employment, Where does the sense of empathy come from? Is it something that's groomed from our parents, something we pick up through the school of hard knocks? Why is one person more have more empathy than another?
First off, we've got to take what's called PDD off the board, Susie, a pervasive developmental disorder. I'm using clinical terms here, but that's where the autism spectrum is. That is a constitutional genetic problem where the child really does not have a sense of the other person's needs. That's why when you have an autistic child, there's a lot of great research on it to help them now. You've got to tell the child, you know, being 3 inches from someone is too close, back off, because they don't have a sense of that. Mm-hmm. So let's take that off the table. For the other majority of human race, empathy is something that is modeled and taught. And here's how it happens. Children come into the world, and then they don't have empathy because they're terrified and young and undeveloped. So they are given empathy. So mom is the source of empathy. She's warm. She comforts them when they're scared. She helps them to be safe and changed and fed and all that. And the child begins to learn, it feels good to have someone looking at me being warm and helpful. Then what happens is then the child begins to give that to others because we can't give what we don't have. So just like God provides love for us, which we give to others, the mom provides for the child, the child provides for others. Then the second stage happens, which is great, where the mom and dad say, stop bonking your sister on the head. That's not nice. don't take those things away. And the child begins to learn, oh, even if I don't feel good about somebody else, I need to be nice to them. I can't just attack people I don't like. Now you've got somebody who really can see, look, see her eyes? She's crying. You made her cry, and that's not an okay thing. And the child learns not only that I received this, but it hurts somebody I care about. That's great empathy training. It'll provide for great marriages and great careers. But when people don't have that, they become people who sort of see other people as need-meeting objects. You're there to make me feel special. You're there to make me feel healthy. You're there to be because you have answers or because you're good with money, I'm not. And healthy people don't put up with that. That's why you've got to have a lot of empathy to go attract high-quality people around you.
Oh, so interesting. I was reading just through your book about when people have this entitlement mentality, and it's such a blind spot. I mean, one of them was, I think, a friend of yours that you were able, I don't know if you befriended him later, but he just was very blind to that, and he went through the school of hard knocks, and then he became a very attentive person and a humble person, teachable person. And you said, okay, what changed? And he's attributed it to this school of hard knocks, and you said, I don't think it's just that, because some people go through hard times and come through it worse than others. And you said we have to come to a place where we own that we have something to do with these attitudes and we have something to do about changing the attitudes. So I want you to speak to that, even make that distinction, because the hard time is or the hard knock kind of thing is an opportunity to change, but it's not necessarily a promise that we're going to change, is it?
It is not a promise. I mean, look at Pharaoh. He got 10 chances.
Yeah.
And he suffered a great deal of hard knocks, and he ended up, you know, without any kind of remorse or repentance. And people always have a choice. And so the best ways I've seen of people changing, and I just think that God just constructed this, is the first thing you do is you tell people in a vulnerable way, here's how you impact me. You know, when you yell, it kind of scares me. Or when you make it about yourself and don't take my feelings into consideration, the team doesn't really want to work with you. And so some people will go, nobody's ever told me that. And because mom and dad didn't do that, they were too busy giving them prizes. And so they'll go, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. And they change. They have low-level entitlement because the words of impact change them. Some other people take actions. You lose jobs. You lose money. You lose marriages. And you're sitting around saying it's other people. And that secondary level, the recovery experts call it hitting bottom. It's when the prodigal son looked around and went, I don't like living with pigs. And that helps. But then there's a third level, the ones you're talking about, where they got the empathy or the impact statement from people, and they also had to suffer greatly, and they're still shaking their fist at God. A certain percentage of them have to suffer longer, I'm sorry to say, than other people, until they finally think, it's not going to get any better until I realize I've got a choice. And then they're fine. They get in a good church. They find the Lord. They get with community. They get retraining. But they had to do it longer than you would like.
Wow.
So that's what my prayer to God for myself and my family and my friends is, let me be the one that just hears a statement. Don't let me suffer because of a hard head. Let me just hear the words and I'll change direction.
Wow, that's amazing. So if you've got somebody in an organization or in a marriage who's saying, my misery is your fault, and what maybe if they're listening today, what would be a first step that they could take if they're willing to humble themselves for a moment?
Let me give three steps.
Okay.
Step one would be, and I just always have to say this, we have to go to Matthew 7 when somebody says, my misery is your fault, and go, could there be some truth to that? Do I need to take the beam out of my eye before I take the mote out of my brother or my sister's eye? So maybe I have been, I don't know, cold or harsh or judgmental or unloving or whatever, and clean that part out, because there could be some truth to that. Nobody ever got changed because somebody judged them into changing. But the second thing is, you say, yeah, I've kind of done my due diligence here. I've been loving and warm and honest, and just because I said no to you because I won't bail you out again, or because you hurt my feelings, I'm not going to spend a lot of time with you. That's when you have to say, how do I phrase this? That's when I have to say, just because somebody is yelling at me doesn't mean something bad is happening. It might mean that person is facing reality. And then you have to go to them and say, I've really thought about it. I don't think my misery is your fault. How can I help you with your misery except saying that I'm going to solve it for you? And certain those people will go, well, you know what? You can support me when I'm out looking for a job. I'll be glad to. But I'm just not going to drive you to a job and in your home base.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Wow. Okay, so you talk about these several principles that, if ignored, will be to our own detriment. Thought they were fantastic. First one is humility and dependence. We are completely dependent on God. And this statement is so great, I might have to post it on my Facebook. Listen to this. I'm going to read what you wrote, John, and I'm sure you're going to be moved by your own words. So get ready. Humility is a much misunderstood attitude and deserves clarification. It's not about having a negative view of yourself. It's not about eating worms. Feelings of self-loathing have more to do with having a harsh judge in your head, and they aren't good for you. Humility is simply accepting the reality of who God is and who you are. When you see the reality of His power, His love, and His care, you more easily see yourself as you are, a loved creature, a special creature, an important creature, but a creature nonetheless. Independence means you look to Him for your sustenance, for every breath you take. So we can try to ignore the fact that we're humility is just the only posture we can take before God, and then we're utterly dependent on Him. But if we do that, it'll be to our own detriment. So say more about this principle that we cannot ignore.
It moves me too, and I think it moves me because it's just the center of what the Bible says.
Indeed.
Think about our pets. I'm a dog guy. We love big dogs in our family. Mm. And my dog is the happiest when he knows he's a dog. But, you know, he jumps around and he's got fairly good training and he chases balls and he's protective and plays with the kids. He never tries to make our house his house. I think it's the same way with us. As humility is saying, I'm not the creator. I don't have that capacity. I'm the creature. And I'm happiest and I fit in life the best when I realize this is okay for me to do. This is God's part. And all of a sudden, I'm comfortable. I'm not feeling like I've got to create things in my own image. And I'm much more fulfilled. That's why humility just says, be strong, be creative, be disruptive. Go out there and change the world a million ways. Just don't try to be God. And we just naturally slip into that role.
Very good. On a side note, I have a pit bull named Memphis, and he's so adorable, and I love him. And I was putting lavender oil on my pillow one night, and he came up, so I put it on his head. He just plopped into bed, and my husband said, and that will be the last time we put essential oils on our pit bull's head. This is as far as that's going. Anyway, I digress. But anyway, that was hilarious. Okay, here's another one that's so important. Connectedness. You said we're designed to live in connectedness with each other. We're designed for it. Say more.
Well, a lot of Christians have the idea that it's just me and God. You know, I pray and I worship and I surrender and I follow His word and I believe in the Holy Spirit. And I do all that stuff. That's what we call the vertical Christian. They can relate very well to God. But the horizontal thing, all they like to do with them is that they give to Him. I have people in my life that I mentor, disciple, and I employ, and I guide, and I coach these people. So they think, my gasoline for life and energy comes from God vertically, but everything with the people I'm with is just outgo. I'm supposed to take care of all these people. Nothing can be further from the truth. The neuroscience backs up what the Bible's been saying for thousands of years. We were meant to be a community where we meet their needs and they meet our needs. And if you turn to 1 Peter 4:10, it's one of my favorite passages, Susie. It says, we are the stewards of God's manifold grace. All right, if we're the stewards of his grace, that means that people are the delivery system of grace to each other. Mm-hmm. So it's not just get the goodies from God and then go help everybody else. Get the goodies from God. Get the goodies from other people. Be vulnerable. Tell people, I need to vent today. Can I take you to coffee and just kind of vent about my crummy day? Or I've been beating myself up because I screwed up on the Smith account. Or I wasn't a very good wife today, and I need you to talk to me about it. We need to need each other just like we need to need God. That's community.
Wow, that is so good. And you think about if we keep ourselves in a position of just giving to others, we really do wall ourselves off. And there's some pride in that because it's like, you need me, but I don't exactly need you. You know,
I have a great statement about that. I love what you're saying, because if that's the way I look at life, if I'm supposed to just get my needs met by God and I'm supposed to take care of other needs, then I'm making those other people sin.
Ooh.
Because they're coming to me to have their needs met, and I don't believe I should do that. I should just come to God. So I'm giving them a system of love and grace that I'm not doing myself.
Wow. All right. Next one, ownership. We have to take responsibility for our own choices. This is something that needs to make a comeback in these days, I think, John. But go ahead and talk to that one.
Well, you know, it all comes back to Galatians 6, Susie, where Paul says, what a person sows, they will reap. And responsibility is just basically saying, I want to sow good things in life. I want to sow love and truth and a work ethic and great relationships. And I should reap, you know, a reasonably happy life and all that. But people that don't look at this, who don't believe in the law of sowing and reaping, think, I need to reap really good stuff. I don't have to do anything about it. And what happens is they get passed over for love, work, jobs, everything, because the world works better when somebody says, and here's the phrase I always use with my clients, my life is my problem. My success in life, my failure in life, that's my problem. I'm going to want to have a lot of support and help and prayers and wisdom from my friends and God, but my life's really my problem. Those people are extremely successful.
So interesting. A friend of mine, her husband was a high-level manager at a big company before he retired, and I asked him, how did you identify people you wanted to promote? And he said, across the board, upper-level management would look at other employees whenever a problem occurred in a certain department, the person who stepped up and said, we'll take care of it, not that it was his fault. And when they would say, well, sometimes they knew that person had nothing to do with the problem, but by that personal ownership saying, well, we've got this, we'll take care of it, that's how they identified future leaders. Thought that was fascinating.
You know, then for the next 20 years in that company, that person will be making things work. In fact, now we found out they're changing how they interview job applicants, because everybody says, you know, what are you good at? What do you love? What's your passion? That's great. But now they're saying, where did you really screw up? And people go, well, I didn't prep for that on the exam.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't see that one coming.
And so some people go, well, not really. I mean, because I was on a great team. Well, this guy let me down. I go, well, I'm not going to use you. But a person goes, well, actually, I was late a lot a couple of years ago to a job, and I shouldn't have been doing that, and they lost my job. They hire that guy because now they're taking ownership.
Oh, interesting. Fascinating. When we come back, we're going to talk about accepting the negative. Your flaws can't be forgiven and healed until you admit them. What do? We compensate, we medicate, we make excuses for, we learn a good dance to dance around. But when we start to accept the negative, when we want to be truly healed from those flaws, just like John was saying, we own them. And then we move on from there. Dr. John Townsend will say more about that when we come back.
Though we stumble, he will. sons. We are the daughters of God.
You know, I chose that song today because we're talking about entitlement. And sometimes I think those who struggle, I should say we who struggle with entitlement, deal with a lack of confidence in a good God and a good God who imparts good gifts to us. I mean, do we not have confidence that he'll give good gifts to us? Do we not have confidence in ourselves that he's equipped us to do good things, to engage our faith, to climb some mountains, you know, to put some things under our feet? Don't you think sometimes the sense of entitlement is, I don't have confidence in me, don't have confidence in God, so I'm going to sit here on this couch of ease and just sort of expect things. It's like you're sabotaging your own success because of your own unbelief. Now, that's my layperson's thoughts. I don't know, Dr. Townsend, and I don't even know if I want you to comment on it because I might be embarrassed. But anyway, I'm just thinking.
I could not agree with you more, Susie.
Wow. Good. Thank you. That dodged that bullet. You know, sometimes I need to be careful with thinking out loud on live radio, but thank you for that. So this is so interesting to me, though. Accepting the negative. Your flaws can't be forgiven and healed until you admit them. And I wonder how many of us go through life somehow skirting and dodging this issue, compensating, medicating, so to speak, but never really getting forward movement in certain parts of our life because we can't dare to face these flaws and thus can't be healed. I want you to unpack that one.
Yeah, I use the metaphor sometimes of somebody goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, how can I help you? And they'll say, I'm fine. I understand that, but you're seeing me for an appointment. I know, but everything's fine. I'm just a positive thinker. And the guy's limping, and he's got a fever, and he's got a weird rash on his hand. The doctor says, I do see signs of some stuff. He goes, no, I just think positive. I just want to come by and tell you hi. Well, that was just made no sense, and the guy didn't get any help. That's what happens when we are afraid of negative reality. You know, I'm a very positive person, and I believe that the Bible's very positive, and God wins in the end and all that stuff. But the negative is where so many people need to grow, because if we have, in other words, sins in our life or brokenness or weaknesses or hurts or failures, they can't get the physician, God, and his body, his people, to come in and say, let me heal that. Let me help you. Let me give you love and support for that. And so they stay in a wounded state. And I think the reason for that, basically, Susie, is that we are so afraid if the negative comes out that we'll be judged. We have shame issues all over the place. So we just wrap it up and say, it's all about God. I don't have any issues. And yet God over and over says, James 5, he says, confess your lacks to one another that you may be healed. So I believe feeling and experiencing the negative gives us a chance to get healthy and well.
Oh, indeed. I mean, that kind of quote-unquote positive thinking is just plain denial. You know, one time I was speaking at a women's conference on the Women at the Well, just saying, you know, about how she got water at an odd time when everybody else drew water in the morning and the evening. And said, sometimes, you know, you showing up late to things is just because you're not managing your schedule well, but other times you're showing up late for self-protection and control. You want to be in control of the situation. And women came up to me after just crying, just saying, I had no idea I was controlling my circumstances to such a degree. But in those places, and even if we are judged and shamed, God's power is greater still, right? I mean, even if people handle us wrong, God's going to handle us right.
Yeah, he is not only the righteous judge, but he is also the reconciler.
Amen. Amen. Okay, here's another principle I want to make sure we cover before we wrap up our time in just a little bit. Finding our role to live long and contentedly, find your purpose in life and fulfill it. Love that. Say more.
Well, this is the opposite of what entitlement is. Entitlement says, I don't need to learn from anybody. I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing is best. And then that person is like a wooden peg in a round, a round peg in a bunch of squares that don't fit in the world. We are happiest when we go to God and say, look, I'm yours. I'm your pit bull with lavender. I belong to you. And so show me what my strengths are. Am I good at music? Am I good at numbers? Am I good at IT? And show me what I'm really good at and have passion for, and use me in a way that makes the world a better place. And when we do that, we fit into the slot, all of a sudden things are great. So it's just a matter of asking God, I just want to know that I can make things better. How can I be your teammate? And he puts us in wonderful places.
And isn't it amazing, John, when we dare to trust him in that way and we start to walk out the thing that he's really designed us for? There's times of reproof, of refining, of correction, of redirection. But when you're in the squeeze of that process, knowing you're making forward progress, you don't want to be anywhere else. I mean, you start to get a vision for what God has. It's like, you know what? I'll take it because the prize is worth the process.
The prize is worth the process. You know, and here's the funny thing about us Christians. Sometimes we think that the only way to be truly sanctified is to be a pastor or a missionary. I felt that for many years. That was the higher end. And I began reading my Bible, and sometimes you might be a pastor or missionary who needs to be in business. It goes both ways, that God doesn't have this split between secular is bad and spiritual is worse. They're all spiritual. And so the idea is to say, God, whether you want me to be in a third world country working with kids or whether you want me to start a business, you tell me because it's all spiritual. And then that takes the pressure off.
Well, we just got about 2 minutes before it's time to wrap up and pray. Would you say a word about the aspect of discipline in our lives? In fact, you even say in your book that some of the most joyful, happy people you know are disciplined. And I'm a pretty disciplined person, but I'm very joyful. I feel like I have freedom because I have discipline. But I think sometimes it can be legalistic. Sometimes it can be interpreted as such, but it's not always. So bring your thoughts into how discipline connects with our freedom, our soul freedom.
Well, I look at discipline as being the car that you're in, that you want to go from here to Los Angeles, but it's got to be driven by gasoline, which is love. And so discipline is, it's got all those things in it that protect and use the love that we have. Discipline really is about love. If you look at the word in the New Testament, in the Greek, another translation of the word, Susie, is nurture. So we've got to start looking at discipline as not as being hard on yourself and being harsh to other people, and it's all about the rules. But just discipline helps me to be healthy enough because I get up in the morning, I work out, and I have a good devotional, and I kiss my spouse goodbye, and I'm nice to my kids. And then I have a structure of going through the day where I'm on time, getting hard things done, writing my reports, talking to customers that don't like me, and get home and take care of things and then have a nice evening. That structure of life is about love. I love my family. I love God. I love my clients. I love my employees. And if you think about it that way, then you get out of the militaristic part and you just think, this is just a way to love more effectively and efficiently. It just drives the love.
Indeed. I'm going to wrap up with this quote before we pray. John writes, "Some of the most enjoyable people in my life have strong discipline. They really can be nice, relaxed, fun people. They just do the right things on a regular basis over and over again, whether they feel like it or not. That's how they come out winners, and they're patient." Such good content. John, I can't thank you enough. I know you're such a busy guy that you would give us time means so much. And as we're getting ready to wrap up, I'm wondering if you would just pray for all of us that we would be there to, I don't know, that negative thing is just sticking with me, that we would grow in the negative, that we would dare to look at our areas of where we need to grow and things that we need to face and trust God in those places.
God, I just think about what Susie just said. I think about what you said in Matthew 21. You said, we need to clean out the cup in ourselves. You're not afraid of the negative. You're not afraid of the hurts, the brokennesses. You're not afraid of the attitudes. Your grace is greater than those. Help us to be free to dig in the cup and be the people you always intended us to be.
Amen. Thank you, John, for the time today.
Always great, Susie.
Always love talking with you as well. Title of his book is The Entitlement Cure, Finding Success in Doing Hard Things the Right Way.
We are the sons, we are the daughters of God. No matter where we go, we're close to the Father's heart. And though we stumble,
such great conversation today. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. Hey, in just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Don't forget to sign up for the Your Sacred Yes study. It starts in a few days. Coming up this Monday, you can sign up for free. All the information is on the Live the Promise show page. Coming up next hour two, my friends Dr. Greg and Aaron Smalley join us to talk about a crazy little thing called marriage. Don't go away. Hour two is up next.